took me to the attack point in Dieppe. I saw the stuff, put a rope on my neck and said, if the British do not come, let's sit over the edge. We took this double, and the reason for it was, the Bormann double, was to kill him and then put Bormann free to travel. We took Bormann out and the other chap was blown to pieces.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Labour Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Only a month to go to the Bond Villains Convention. Why are NATO's secret political masters so shy about where they're meeting this year? Where will Bilderberg 2019 be? The secret meetings of the most powerful corporate titans, from the banks, the media, even monarchs in the NATO countries, which for the first 20 years were chaired by a former SS officer. No solid leaks, I'm afraid, but some good educated guesswork. Also, the Lebanese publish a Saudi cable to their Sri Lanka embassy, which implicates them in the Easter attacks on churches, which left 250 dead, 45 of them children. Why is Facebook blocking one of the Lebanese media websites that published the leak? They decided it's fake news and we're not allowed to know. Not even allowed to discuss it. Despite the evidence. And Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is back, not dead after all. Looking a bit greyer. A video encouraging a new wave of attacks on the West. But who is this guy? And who pays the piper? Plus, Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt threatening Russia and calling Putin's TV station out as a propaganda channel, and YouTube actually blocking the Iranian state media, Press TV. What are they afraid of? The truth might puncture a dirty great hole through their 200 channels of propaganda? Sister Show Dialects here on BCFM Tuesday at noon. This week, the history professor Peter Fleming from the University of the West of England talks about the real Robin Hood at the Save Redland Library campaign. Also, Eric Walker has been running a peace and social justice film lending service to Ipswich for the last 60 years. He's annoyed by today's Westminster Abbey Thanksgiving service for Britain's nuclear weapons. What are the Church of England playing at? Plus, Binary Economies and an author, Rodney Shakespeare, helping explain why the financial system's closing in on us like a prison and how to get out of it while we still have the freedom to do so. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But let's start, Martin, with this today's service for nuclear weapons Thanksgiving at Westminster Abbey. This is unprecedented, and actually I'm not sure that there's been anything really in to do with the church blessing nuclear weapons before. It's almost like having the priest kissing the bomb as it goes on the plane to blow up thousands of people.
Well, I'm personally flabbergasted. I didn't know this had happened. And as you know, my mother was a priest in the Church of England, and I'm quite sure that she would not be very happy to find that this was going on. The church, many, Canon Collins, of course, and many others, were very vocal opponents of nuclear weapons for many years. And it does seem rather odd that they've chosen to have a church service to bless them.
Now, I spoke, as I just said there, to Eric Walker from Concord Media over in Ipswich, who's has done 60 years of sort of peace campaigning. He lends out films all around the country, all around the world, for viewings of various sorts and to universities, that sort of thing, and sells them too. So what does Eric have to say about today's Thanksgiving service for UK nuclear weapons at Westminster Abbey with Prince William?
Jesus Christ, if people remember, was rather a pacifist. He wasn't completely peaceful because he overturned the tables in the temple of the moneylenders and traders, but he was certainly not a warlike person. The first Christians, of course, were pacifists.
Actually, what they're saying is that nuclear weapons have kept the peace.
That's a question it's impossible to answer, isn't it, when you think about it? How can you know whether it was nuclear weapons that kept the peace? You can't prove it either way. Just because we have peace, it doesn't mean to say that it was nuclear weapons that stopped it. I understand that there have been two occasions when orders were given to submarine commanders, both to Russian and to American, and the submarine commanders refused to carry out the orders to send off rockets. One was during the Cuba missile crisis. I don't know much about the structure of the Church of England, but you have a dean and you have a chapter. Incidentally, of course, one of the founders of CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, was the dean of St. Paul's. He was a leading figure, the dean of St. Paul's.
And what signal do you think this service, if it goes ahead, what signal does it send to the wider world?
I think it'll tell you what a load of hypocrites. I mean, let's face it, they aren't our own nuclear weapons anyway, they're American, and it's very disputed as to how much say we have in the use of them.
Well, surely this is an independent nuclear deterrent in these Royal Navy submarines.
In theory, lots of things are said, but it doesn't mean to say because someone says something that it is so.
Well, that's right. I mean, Britain's nuclear deterrent is a joke. I mean, it would never be used in any conceivable circumstances. You could argue that the Russians and the Americans having nuclear weapons has kept the peace, but Britain having nuclear weapons, it's just an irritant and a waste of money. It's that there's never been any. I mean, Switzerland doesn't have nuclear weapons. It's been quite peaceful as well, hasn't it?
Some people say that the British money that the British spend on their nuclear weapons are really just a way of the British paying for US nuclear weapons.
Well, they'd be right. In other words, it's a waste of money. And there's plenty of military people who would say, well, actually, we're never going to use these things, and we've got people in Afghanistan with no boots.
And what about the role of the Church of England in creating CND in the first place in the 1950s?
Well, indeed, not the Church of England, but people within
it. Well, that's right, yes. I mean, talking about the Dean of St. Paul's.
Well, I mean, what's happened here is, I imagine, that the Royal Navy have put twisted arms that they want to have this service, and foolishly the Church of England has agreed to give it to them.
Foolishly, or do you think?
Well, yeah, foolishly, because as you say, it doesn't do anything for the image of the Church to be seen to be blessing nuclear weapons. It really doesn't.
What about this claim that sometimes these nuclear weapons may have actually been used and maybe possibly even to start a war and maybe being used, going to be used in the future?
Well, the Americans have threatened to use nuclear weapons against their opponents more than 50 times since World War II. They've never gone through it. The North Vietnamese said, go on, we dare you.
But we have, the Royal Navy hasn't, has it?
Well, we've nearly got involved in nuclear wars by accident. And you remember a couple of years ago now, the Royal Navy were blasting missiles off towards Africa, supposedly, in the Caribbean, and the missiles veered off towards the United States. And as you said...
This is a test firing of
a Trident. And as we joked on this show, maybe the Royal Navy are having a bit of a laugh. The only possible use for a nuclear deterrent of Britain is to deter the Americans if they were trying to carry out a coup against the Labour government or something like that, saying, back off, we've got nuclear weapons, we can nuke you. We'd never use them in any other circumstances. We probably wouldn't even use them in those circumstances. Total waste of money.
Okay, another piece of news this week is the release in Lebanon of cables of some sort, all in Arabic. I mean, I can't read the stuff, but they have very kindly in Lebanon translated them, saying that the Saudi embassy the headline is Saudi Arabia has literally Sri Lankan blood on its hands in a leaked urgent confidential top secret document, Saudi Arabian Ministry of Foreign Affairs confesses responsibility for at least relations to the terrorist attacks that Sri Lanka hit Sri Lanka 2 weeks ago at Christians, as Christians celebrated Easter Sunday. Obtained by Al Ahed, the paper, which carries the date of the 11th 1440, oh gosh, that's sorry, some completely different date system, and they've translated us very kindly as 16th of April 2019, 5 days before the massacre, was penned by Saudi Foreign Minister Ibrahim bin Abdul Adz Al-Asaf, is his signature on the bottom of it, and the letter sent to Saudi Ambassador in Sri Lanka Abdul Nasser Al-Harethi.
Well, Tony, the Saudis have been involved in Wahhabi terrorism since the 1980s, when Operation Cyclone was set up with the MI6 as the lead agency to funnel jihadi terrorists who'd been formed in madrasas all over the world into Afghanistan to fight the Russians with British army training.
What could the motive possibly be here?
Well, the motive in this is quite clear. Sri Lanka is getting involved the Chinese One Belt, One Road project. The new government in Sri Lanka is very pro-Chinese, so the Indians don't like that, the West doesn't like that, and the Saudis don't like that, and that's why it's so strange, because there's hardly any Muslims in Sri Lanka, but they've turned into and of course the same thing has happened with the Rohingya in Burma, where the Western powers are supporting Aung San Suu Kyi and her government and the military there to suppress the Rohingya, but the Rohingya themselves are being armed and trained by Saudis to fight the Burmese army.
So in other words, what you're trying to do there is
set everybody against everybody else, and you can prevent the Chinese with their world plan.
We don't often hear, but actually the Israelis have been supplying weapons to the government of Myanmar, Burma, haven't they, too?
Yes, and the Saudis have been arming the other side. So what you've got, actually, and of course this is what goes on a lot in international affairs, is that if you want to destabilise a country, you arm both sides of a conflict so that it descends into civil war, so then they can't build the railway line, which the Chinese want to build through Burma, to develop the region as they see it.
What they actually want, the Chinese, is to have a railway running right, freight railway, coming right to the UK through the Channel Tunnel, etc.
Well, the One Belt, One Road project is basically a Marshall Plan for the developing world. The Chinese have got the capital, and they're saying we want to invest in infrastructure all over the world, because the West will never do it, because the West is basically selfish and doesn't
they do
care
it,
about it.
Anyone that actually takes that Chinese dollar may get a terrorist
well,
attack.
Well, exactly. And of course, I bet the Sri Lankan intelligence services know exactly who did it and why.
Let's get back to the document itself. It says, translates as the following: urgent. This is from Saudi Arabia to the ambassador in Sri Lanka 5 days before the attack. It says, urgent, top secret, His Excellency Ambassador Abdul Nasser bin Hussein Al-Harethi. You should carry out the following measures immediately. Delete all documents, computer data and latest correspondence with domestic foreign members and groups, in addition to imposing a curfew for the embassy personnel. Inform all those related to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, including councillors, security forces and intelligence, during the 3 coming days, especially the Christian Easter Day, to avoid presence in public and crowded places, namely churches. You should send written news about the Sri Lankan authorities and their viewpoints regularly to the minister, Ibrahim bin Abdul Aziz Asaf, foreign minister. So that is really a bit of a smoking gun, it sounds.
Well, it implies they had foreknowledge. And, of course, the Indians were supposedly the people who tipped off the Sri Lankans, and the Sri Lankans didn't respond. But the Indians have got their own reasons to destabilise Sri Lanka, because, of course, they don't like, you know, they're opposed to the Chinese proposals as well. And Sri Lanka is aligned to some extent with Pakistan. So there's usually a bigger story than just nutcases blowing things up because they're nutcases. And it's, in this case, I would say definitely so.
Why the Saudis? What is the motive to attack churches, though? I mean,
well, the Saudis are basically they've hot-housed this Wahhabist, Salafist, Takfiri terrorist movement for many years, and of course all 19 hijackers supposedly on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. That's why we invaded Afghanistan. Hee-haw. The fact is that the Saudi intelligence service have been working with MI6 and the CIA for years, and with Mossad.
Okay, and also
they're basically stirring things up.
Beheadings of 37 people in Saudi Arabia, public beheadings. Not a lot of reporting of that. I mean, this includes kids. that have been just...
Well, they're teenagers.
Basically, well, yes, teenagers are protesting against the government in one sort or another. And suddenly, crikey, you know, your head's chopped
off.
Yeah,
well, when a few protesters were killed in Syria a few years ago, we said it was time for an armed struggle, time to put them all up against the wall and shoot them. And we were going, yeah, 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 revolution comes all the way. So there's got to be a revolution in Syria. Assad must go. Gaddafi must be shot in the head and bayoneted up the backside. But, of course, in Saudi Arabia, they behead people and they should just wait for reform. Reform will come eventually.
And in the same week, CENTCOM chief has suggested readiness to deter an unspecified Iranian action. This is the commander of US Central Command, CENTCOM, which has just been designated as a terrorist organisation by the Iranian government. So I guess he's like head terrorist honcho. And he's reportedly implied his forces possess essential resources to deter what he claimed as dangerous actions by Iran, insisting on long-term presence of his US forces in Iraq. I believe we'll have the resources necessary to deter Iran from taking any actions that will be dangerous, says General Kenneth McKenzie, as quoted by Sky News Arabia. We will be able to respond effectively, during a visit to the Persian Gulf region, without pointing to any specific threat. So there's this constant tension, isn't there, between the US and Iran, Martin, including this last week. It was the Google company that's just closed, for an unspecified reason, just closed their YouTube account, which has something like 150,000 subscribers, possibly more, millions of hits on YouTube. Now, all those subscribers have been lost to them.
Well, I mean, we're bowling towards a war with Iran. And today, I believe, the Americans have said that nobody is to buy Iranian oil, including the Chinese, for whom the Iranian oil is their main oil supplier. They've been told you can't buy it, and if you do, we're going to have sanctions on your companies that do buy it. And no, and apparently, I was reading that there's actually Iranian oil already in China in the dock, ready to be unloaded, but no Chinese enterprises will touch it because they don't want to be sanctioned by the Americans. And the Chinese leadership are having to decide what they're going to respond to this. And the various countries do depend on Iranian oil, and of course they will find ways round it. But the Americans have also said, well, if necessary, we're going to blockade and we won't let you export your oil in tankers and so on. And what the Iranians have said, well, in that case, we're going to close the Strait of Hormuz. Now, we're actually very much very close
on, because
to a war
the Pentagon,
with Iran.
The Pentagon is actually, sorry, that Congress, whoops, bit of a mistake there, Congress has tried to actually stop the war with Yemen, hasn't it? And it's failed because Trump has vetoed
Trump
it.
Trump has vetoed
and
it.
And in fact, they've tried to overturn his veto and failed then there too. So what is the point of the US? Why is Trump behind this war against Yemen?
Because Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is in bed with Mohammed bin Salman. They are basically business partners, and the Saudis and the deep state in the US have been in cahoots for years. And as you know, we've covered the 9/11 attacks extensively on this program over the last decade, and it's pretty clear that the Saudi intelligence services, the Mukhabarat, work very closely with the CIA and MI6, and they're all terrorists. They really are.
Now, Martin, have you ever heard of something called... Because, I mean, a lot of people question us. They say, well, surely all this stuff doesn't really go on behind the scenes. Well, we think it does. Mm-hmm. And we're not just the only ones. There are some academics around the world. Have you ever heard of something called Operation Timber Sycamore?
Not offhand? What is it?
Well, we're about to find out, because according to Daniela Ganser, that was the name given by the Pentagon to the inducing and starting a civil war in Syria. And he explains why he thinks and how that all happened, because we get nothing of this on the mainstream press at all, do we, about what is really going on behind the scenes.
Can you just explain who Daniela Ganser is for the audience?
Well, he's the author of a book called NATO's Secret Armies, which is one of the first books on the devious techniques used, I mean, really illegal, criminal, war criminal techniques used by governments and particularly by the military, and also by secret committees that are outside the purview of Parliament. And we're talking really here about NATO intelligence services mainly, plus the Israeli intelligence services, and various bomb attacks and terrorist attacks that they have been carrying out over the decades in order to make us think that somebody else is attacking us. But anyway, here he is talking about the Syrian civil war and what was a covert operation called Timber Sycamore. And he's from one of the big universities over in Switzerland.
It's like this story of this kid was really angry with his family, so he left the house. And before he left the house, he blew it up with his mother and his sister and his father, all dead. It's just a stupid story. And it was a lie. So this is really covert action. You're carrying out an operation, and you hide behind the concept of plausible deniability. You say, I didn't do that. You lie. It's not that this is something years ago, you know, that didn't happen anymore. In 2011, the Syrian war started. And you can't understand the Syrian war if you don't see the element of covert action, because Syria was basically covert action from the start. The CIA invested $1 billion, okay, that's a one and nine zeros. This is a lot of cash, much more cash than everybody of us has, into a covert operation in Syria with the name Operation Timber Sycamore. This operation aimed at overthrowing the government in Syria, Assad. And that's, again, illegal. It's the same pattern that you had with Fidel Castro. It's a story with Cuba. Fidel Castro survived, right? He defeated this invasion. Then the CIA later tried to kill him with assassination operations. They knew that Fidel Castro liked to go scuba diving. So they planted seashells with explosives. And they thought he would, you know, touch it and die. It didn't work. Fidel Castro survived. And that's the same now with Assad, okay? Assad seems to be surviving the secret war of the CIA. And the very strange thing is that the CIA doesn't care about the group that they arm, okay? They go to radical Muslims, give them money, give them weapons, and say, overthrow Assad. When the public then says, are you really doing this? They say, oh no, I'm not doing this. This is just an internal war in Syria. Looks, it was a secret war from the start. And the second thing that you do, if you're an empire, and the United States is the empire, you use your special forces. What are special forces? Special forces are, in Great Britain, for instance, the SIS, Special Air Services, or in the United States, the Green Berets. And they go to many countries. They enter the country without a declaration of war, okay? So they enter illegally. The host country doesn't even know that they're coming. And they don't have, you know, the American flag or the British flag or the French flag here and here the name. They have no insignia. And they're the best, okay? They can survive alone in the desert, in the jungle, and in the mountains. So they're really the hard guys. And what they do is they fight behind enemy lines. They train groups to then overthrow governments. And I said that in Cuba it didn't work. In Syria, the war has changed into an open war. Obama started to bomb the country. Trump is continuing to bomb the country. So a secret war can change into an open war. But still, Syria, it's not sure whether the U.S. empire will be able to overthrow Assad. And in other cases, we really have examples where it worked. So, for instance, in 1953, the MI6, the British Secret Service, and the CIA overthrew the government of Mossadegh, Prime Minister in Iran. That was totally illegal. People in Europe and America have completely forgotten about it, but the Iranians have not forgotten. In 1973, the CIA overthrew the government of Allende in Chile. In 1979, the CIA started to arm the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Okay? And they, many people don't remember that the CIA actually built up Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan because they wanted to create, I quote, a Vietnam for the Russians. You know, they drew the Russians into Afghanistan. The Russians fought against the Afghani, against the Mujahideen. And the CIA supported them. In the 80s, it was not a secret anymore. But in the beginning, it was a total secret. So secret warfare is something I've worked on for many, many years. And basically, you can say you don't read about it in the newspaper. You just don't. Or only many years later. You don't hear about it on television. Or only many years later. And therefore, people get a very wrong picture of international politics. They don't understand that secret war exists.
That's Daniela Ganser Martin. He's at the University of Basel, just over the road from the Bank for International Settlements, which is where all the international bankers meet. My goodness, there's a bit of an epicentre of interest there. But the real question here is, I mean, actually what he's saying there does give us the tools, doesn't it, to interpret almost every terrorist attack. When we see something and it doesn't look quite right, like the Sri Lanka terrorists, like what can you possibly have to gain by killing all these children and people on Easter Sunday? Actually, Daniela is saying that there's something else going on, and if you really look into it, you'll find that there's something to be learned from every terrorist attack. As you actually yourself pointed out at the 9/11 attacks, you immediately were suspicious about them. And so what is exactly the picture that he's painting that we need to learn when we want to understand why a terror attack like the Sri Lanka attack is happening?
Well, an obvious thing to tell people to do is just do a computer search for on the word Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, which is the code name for the Western European terrorist networks, which were set up by NATO in the 1940s. And Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, he died in 2012. He wrote a book just before he died called La Repubblica degli Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, because of course the Bologna...
We can't really read that because it's...
No, but I mean, the point is you can find information about it.
It's in Italian, but look, the take home here is this was actually picked up from the last days of the Nazis, wasn't it?
Indeed.
This is the werewolf networks, which the Nazis set up, which were actually integrated into NATO. The idea was these were stay-behind forces. The Nazis created cells, effectively, to do sabotage and that sort of thing behind enemy lines as the Allies and the Soviet forces advanced, and they were actually kept on by NATO.
They were. I mean, Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo, becomes the head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Services. And basically what he did is he said to the Dulles brothers and the people in the CIAs, I've got loads of spies out there inside the Soviet Union and all over Western Europe. Do you want them?
Alan Dulles was in Basel, wasn't he, during the war?
Well, indeed. I mean, the point is that what they did, and you know, we've covered a lot of this stuff about how Bormann was extracted and taken to Argentina and the rat lines and stuff. I mean, Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, was sent to Bolivia, where he was employed by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. In other words, what happened at the end of the war is that the most extreme Nazis were integrated into the NATO intelligence structure, and that's why you got all of this false flag terrorism happening, assassinations of prime ministers in Belgium and Italy, bombs going off,
but
like the Bologna bomb that killed 80 odd people.
Nowadays it's not Russian Soviet inspired terrorism, it's apparently Islamic, Islamist inspired terrorism, and we've seen this week the reappearance of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He's not dead after all, is he? And he's now calling for a whole new wave of attacks on the West. So what do you make of his reappearance?
Well, in the first place, al-Baghdadi was interned in Iraq by the Americans, and he was then released, and he then set up the whole structure of ISIS, what we now call ISIS. And basically, he is basically working for the Saudis, and the Saudis work for the Israelis, the British, and the Americans.
One of the things I found amazing was that there's actually pictures of him having meetings with John McCain.
Yes, John McCain went into Syria at one stage to support the democratic revolutionaries, and we've got a picture of him shaking hands with al-Baghdadi. Well, there you go. Because they're all in the same pot.
Well, why? I mean, surely maybe he's just trying to negotiate with him at that point.
No, the people have got to realise that the history goes back decades. Of when they decided to create the Islamic International Brigades, which fought inside Afghanistan and from all over the world, a lot of them from Libya and from Benghazi, they were basically orchestrated and the Americans subcontracted that to the British, because the British had all of the contacts in the Islamic world, including in Saudi Arabia. So in actual fact, this country at one stage, the French police were calling London, Londonistan, because and in Manchester, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group had been based in Manchester since the 1980s. And of course, the boy that blew himself up, supposedly in the Manchester bomb, he was in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, as his father was, who made a statement in Tripoli after he was accused of being it. In other words, we've we've got a lot of Islamistic extremism in Britain because we've been the centre of Islamistic extremism since the 1980s because MI6 invited them all in.
They also, the CIA, turned Guantanamo Bay inmates into double agents, didn't they? This is like does look as if this may be the Baghdadi scenario here. As a controversial secret programme turned Al-Qaeda suspects into spies with the lure of freedom and safety for families and millions of cash. There were these two basically wings over at Guantanamo Bay, which you can imagine being in other of these secret jails. One was called Penny Lane and the other Strawberry Fields.
Yeah, Strawberry Fields are forever, you're staying. Penny Lane, you're going out to do stuff
down
for us.
Penny Lane, yeah.
Now, in other words, it shouldn't be difficult for people to get this. Islamist extremism of the Saudi stripe has been orchestrated by Western intelligence services since the 1980s.
But why are the motives of Western intelligence services to actually encourage ISIS fighters to start blowing up Britain and other Western countries?
Because at that point you then say, oh gosh, we need more funds for funds to defeat terrorism, and we're going to have to invade, name your country.
Is this why MI6 and MI5 have failed to interview almost all of these people as they've come back to
the
UK?
Well, as you know, Abu Hamza, Captain Hook, was basically an MI5 agent all wrong. The mastermind named by the Metropolitan Police on the 7/7 bombing attack,
Haroun Aswat,
was arrested and then...
Hamza even gave his code name, didn't he? He said, my code name was Damson Berry.
That's right.
I mean, did he just...
Now, in other words, the way they kind of justify this is say, well, we've infiltrated everything, and of course, that's our job. But of course, they're not infiltrating it to stop these people, they're infiltrating it to direct these people. And it's established historical fact beyond any doubt whatsoever that Al-Qaeda was set up by Western intelligence services. The story we're told is that we set them all up, but then they turned on us. What can you do? And my answer to that, if I was a Russian general staff officer, is rubbish. We know what you're up to. We've always known what you're up to.
Now, Martin, the focus of all this, of course, at the moment, is building up tension with Iran. So let's listen to that. That came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Jeremy Le Fry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe has now been in prison in Tehran for more than 3 years, deprived of the presence of her family. Would the Prime Minister join with me in assuring her and all those who are unjustly imprisoned overseas, as the Honourable Member mentioned earlier, that they are not forgotten in this House? And would she update the House on what measures are being taken to ensure that Nazanin can come home as soon as possible and in the meantime get the treatment, medical treatment she so desperately needs?
Yes. Prime Minister!
Or give the general reassurance that my Honourable Friend asked for, that these cases are not forgotten, that they continue to be worked on by ministers and officials. Her case and others in relation to Iran, I raise whenever I see President Rouhani, I raise these issues. The Foreign Secretary raises them with his opposite numbers. We are constantly raising these issues, but we are also ensuring that in terms of our presence in Iran, that they are working with the Iranian authorities as far as possible to ensure that the necessary medical assistance is provided to Nazanin, and indeed that others are supported in the way that they need to be. But I can assure my Honourable Friend that these cases are not forgotten. We continue to work on them and continue to raise them regularly with the Iranian authorities.
Well, the Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif today has said that war with the United States is not imminent, but accidents are possible. This is a dangerous phase, isn't it?
It's a very dangerous situation, and I think people are very complacent. We've got so used to war now. Do you remember all the reaction there was to the invasion of Iraq? And there was a huge kind of outpouring of protest, and we've basically been battered down to the point now where another war is just another war. But this is potentially very, very dangerous. In relation to this particular case, if you will remember, Boris Johnson came to the House of Commons and said, well, this is a terrible thing, the Iranians have arrested this lady, and all she was doing was training journalists. She was supposed to be on holiday. And no doubt he was briefed that she was training journalists, and he wasn't supposed to stay there.
Well,
in the House of Commons.
Training journalists is not a crime.
No, but she was supposed to be there on a tourist visa, Tony. She's not supposed to be there training journalists. And, of course, in other words, she is an MI6 agent, basically, and the Iranians are holding her as such.
Well, she could be a BBC agent.
There's an overlap there. The point is that the Iranians are also saying, so you want us to give you this lady back, but you're going to have sanctions on us for this, you're going to tell us about this, blah, 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 blah. So what are you going to give us for that? Well, you're going to go along with the Americans and go to war with us, aren't you? Well, maybe we'll just hold her as a hostage. What do you think?
So the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, he's coming to the fore. He's a very good English speaker, but we don't ever hear him on the BBC. We hear very, very rarely anywhere in the West, do we?
Well, we never hear any of these voices of these people that were bombing and attacking and killing. You know, they are non-people, although the modern world of the internet allows people to communicate in much easier ways than they used to. And as you know, you and I, but you more than I, have done work for Press TV. I'm not working more with RT, but the fact is English language broadcasting is a fantastic means for us all to communicate, and that's why they don't want us. The Iranians basically are people like us, and if you hear them talking, we had the guy from Hezbollah came to Bristol several years ago now. I've saw lots of people fussing and saying, oh, this is terrible, Hezbollah's coming to Bristol, blah, blah, blah. When he spoke in the council house, he was incredibly well-spoken and very well thoughtful guy. But you wouldn't think so from the way, you know, these people are all presented. Oh, you don't, you know, there's a deliberate creation of ignorance about our opponents, and of course we've got to break that down. We need to talk to people. Even if you're fighting with people, you should talk to them. The Vietnamese talked with the Americans day in, day out, even as they're killing their soldiers.
Can we trust
years.
What people like Hezbollah say about, for example, the Saudis being linked to Sri Lanka?
Well, no, it's not Hezbollah who said that. This is independent media in Lebanon. But people in Lebanon, because they had a civil war, are much more aware of the ins and outs of all of this than other people in other parts of the world. And what's interesting in Lebanon is that the Christian community and the Shia community and the sensible people in the Sunni community have aligned together to prevent a civil war potentially being restarted by the Israelis. But the Israelis, Nasrallah, who's the head of Hezbollah, said it's likely that the Israelis are going to attack Lebanon this summer, and we're expecting them to be able to kill off all of our leadership, including me. But we're ready, prepared, and we all know. There was a big meeting where he pulled all of his people in. And Hezbollah are very well organised. You probably do know this, Tony, but they've got a Christian brigade. So there's a Christian brigade of Hezbollah.
Well, don't they have a whole sort of multi faith government system?
Well, they have a multi faith government system, which was the result
faiths, all in key positions.
Yeah, the result of the civil war was a power sharing thing where everybody got a piece of the cake. That's right. And Hezbollah have government ministers in Lebanon who cooperate with their Sunni and Christian counterparts.
Okay,
and
so
all three communities have managed to kind of, you know, build the country up.
So let's go
and 6,000
miles or so to the west. Venezuela is an attempted coup this week by Juan Guaido. I kept hearing lots of pro-Guaido people. I didn't hear very many Venezuelan government people on any of our Western media, including the BBC World Service. So it seems to have fizzled out, actually.
Well, it has, but at the same time, of course, the situation is dire because there have been sanctions on Venezuela for years, which have been escalated. There's a deliberate manipulation of the oil price as well by the Saudis and the Americans. They're trying to take the Iranian oil off the international market, force the price down, because that then creates a situation where Russia and Venezuela then run out of money. And of course, that's the game that they're playing. And, you know, it's very difficult. And of course, the people in Venezuela are very split. The poor tend to support the government. The rich tend to support the opposition.
And what about Eric Prince, Blackwater? Well, he's called something else now, isn't it? Academy or XE or something. He changes his name every few years. As soon as people realise just what an evil business it is he's running, a merchant of death, basically. And they seem to be quite good at getting off court cases as well around the world, Blackwater. But he's recruiting mercenaries to topple Maduro.
Well, apparently what he did is he approached Trump and said, I can recruit 5,000 mercenaries which we can infiltrate into Venezuela to topple the elected government. And Trump's going, yeah.
How much is that going to cost?
Well, that's the US taxpayer who hasn't got any health care, eh?
I mean, if they spent $1 billion in Syria, I mean, surely, you know, giving a few bob to, they'll manage to do, you know, give a few cents, dollars or whatever to Eric Prince, won't they?
Well, they might. I mean, they're clearly spending a lot of money trying to overthrow the Chavista regime in Venezuela. But they're finding it more difficult than they thought, because of all the Latin American countries, it's the only one where the army basically supports the leftist government. You had something vaguely similar in Peru in the 1960s with the Velasco regime. General Velasco was a military dictator in Peru, but because he'd been involved in suppression of kind of left-wing freedom fighters, whatever you want to call them, they then moved the country to the left. But in Venezuela, Chavez was a paratroops lieutenant colonel initially,
and since you
therefore
mentioned,
he's got a lot of support in the army.
On this program, but I noticed just a couple of weeks ago, Alan Garcia, the former Peruvian president, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound as the police were raiding his home. Now, that does sound to me as if possibly he was killed rather than he just decided to kill himself.
Well, Alan Garcia in the 1980s, when he was elected president of Peru, was one of the first people in the world to turn around and say, we're not going to pay our international debts. They're not fair. They've been imposed on us by military governments in the past and by Wall Street, and we're just not going to pay. And, of course, what actually happened was that the Garcia was removed, basically, and Peru eventually, Fujimori took over, and they paid all their debts because, you know, it's basically a protection racket around the world. People in Latin America are far more aware of this than we are, that money just leaks out of the country every... You know, governments collect their taxes very, very reluctantly from the people who can afford to pay. They don't spend it on anything local. It just goes straight off to Wall Street to keep those people happy.
I think this is one of the reasons over the last few weeks I've been mentioning this 1MDB scandal over in Malaysia, because it's really telling. It seems to me that what's being exposed in Malaysia at the moment is the way that many countries operate, effectively with the financial system bribing political parties, key political individuals, presidents, etc. And it does seem as if that's actually being exposed in Malaysia, where it's been going on in many other countries, including Western countries. We had that incredible Gürtel scandal in Spain, where the People's Party had a massive slush fund, which was being paid to them by corporate interests to do whatever they were, basically to win elections, in exchange for giving contracts, government contracts, to those companies. So, in a way, you can see that may be what's being exposed now in Malaysia, may be exactly what's really going on in other parts of the world, where actually it's the financial system. People like Goldman Sachs, who, by the way, are appointing finance ministers right across Europe these days, are the people who are calling the shots.
Well, when we were talking about electoral...
It doesn't matter who you vote for, you're still going to get a Goldman Sachs finance
Well,
minister.
When we were talking about electoral reform earlier and all the rest of it and the problems with our democracy, one of the major problems is that it's actually bought. It's all bought. Money decides. And those with money... I mean, in the US, the Citizens United bill that went through the Supreme Court means that anybody can chuck any amount of money at an election, and they don't even have to say that they've spent it. So when elections take place in the US, there's loads of advertising, negative advertising, a lot of it, to try and get people elected, and you don't even know who's paid for it, and you're not supposed to know. And that's really fundamental. Of course, in Scandinavian countries like Norway, there are very, very strict rules. They have a situation where each political party gets an amount of money depending on what they got last time, and that's all they get. No other money is allowed to be spent. But, you know, the attacks in Christchurch were very similar to what happened in the Utoya Island attack, where basically Breivik killed off what was potentially the future Labour leadership of Norway. We're all killed off in one go, and the rest of them completely traumatised. And we're dealing with very fascistic corporate criminals of a very, very nasty stripe.
In Malaysia, the figures Goldman Sachs are implicated in and others is, they reckon about $7 billion was appropriated by the president for his own purposes and to give to his mates, basically.
Yeah, well, in Malaysia, because of Mahathir Mohamad, who was the previous president, they've got a relatively independent approach there. So, for example, Mahathir Mohamad has openly said he doesn't believe the story about 9/11. He's called for Israel to be kicked out of the United Nations.
Hang on a minute. They didn't just do that, did they, Malaysia? They had war crimes trials of Bush, Blair, and various of the Israelis, including Zippy Livni. And if they were to now visit Malaysia, they would be arrested at the airport.
Yeah, and the other thing they did in 1998 during the economic crisis, they imposed exchange controls, which the IMF said, you can't do that. Nobody's allowed to have exchange controls. They said, we're going to do it. And they did it, and it worked. And that's obviously, if there's another if there's another financial crisis, countries are going to have to impose exchange controls, even though it's not in the IMF textbook. And Malaysia did it and got away with it. And that's probably the reason why it's their aircraft which are chosen for these false flag attacks, like the one in Ukraine. And the Malaysians, in fact, don't accept the story about who shot down their plane in Ukraine. They've always said, we don't believe what you're telling us.
So Mahathir, though, is an anti-Semite, isn't he?
Well, according to those who say
he is. I mean, he's extremely anti-Jewish.
He's extremely anti-Israel. And I'm not going to defend Mahathir Mohamad because he's a nationalist and I'm a socialist. But at the same time, the point about him is he's very old now. He's in his 90s. He's just been re-elected as the president, which is why all this stuff's come to light. He's basically, from the point of view of the empire, if you like, he's an awkward customer. And Malaysia is an awkward country. Similar things in Thailand, because the Thais are quite, they're trying to balance between the Chinese and the West. And there, there's a lot of manipulation going on there. But there's a huge struggle going on for the domination of the 21st century between, the Western powers, which have run the world since the 1500s, and, the rest of the world coming saying, hang on a minute, what about the rest of us? And the Chinese are basically saying, well, get behind us and we'll change it all.
Okay,
and of course, that's a threat to everybody.
Also, this week in court has been Julian Assange. Well, he won one court case, but lost the other one. So he's not going to be immediately extradited to the US, but apparently for jumping bail, he's got to do a year in prison. Now, somebody that has successfully fought US extradition on these sorts of charges is a guy called Laurie Love, who appeared on Press TV, on RT UK this week. Laurie Love.
It's worth fighting. It's going to be an uphill struggle because, unfortunately, the presumption is usually in favour of the US. But we managed to prove in my case that if you try hard enough, you get enough public support, and if you are right, then you can beat it. And I hope that will apply to Julian. We lost in the first court, so Westminster Magistrates Court, we lost. We won at the High Court, at the Royal Courts of Justice, and that was, I think, because of the campaign and because of the strong arguments relating to problems with the US justice system and prison conditions, and all of that would apply to Julian. I'm still waiting to be prosecuted for the alleged offending. Here in the UK, it would have been 36 months. In the US, it would have been up to 99 years. And with Julian, while they're claiming that it's a minor conspiracy charge with 5 years, I think we all know that they're likely to spring more charges under the Espionage Act, and he would be similarly facing life or potentially a death sentence under the Espionage Act. And conditions in US prisons are reprehensible. They're horrific.
Well, Assange, we had Magna Carta in 1215 and habeas corpus. This is in complete defiance of that. He's not committed any offence under British law, but he's being extradited to the US even though he's an Australian citizen. It's a disgrace.
So, another question we have on here from time to time is these accusations of anti-Semitism, and there's certainly a lot of that going around in the Labour Party. And one of the people who came up for criticism, people who apparently are not supposed to criticise, is a guy called George Soros. He's a Jewish, Hungarian, an international financier. And if I did an internet search on him and anti-Semitism, apparently there's lots and lots of spoken about him people who speak about George Soros are accused of anti-Semitism. I thought, let's go to the man himself and see what he says about his days as a teenager when he was in Hungary under Nazi occupation. And so here is George Soros speaking on a documentary, 60 Minutes documentary, back in 1998, where he very clearly says, and in fact twice admits to, helping the Nazis to confiscate goods from his Jewish neighbours, even though he was Jewish himself. So we now know, of course, that he says that you can use bad money for good purposes. But this is how apparently it all started. And this documentary, 60 Minutes, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, from 1998 on US network CBS.
This year, Soros plans to give away almost $500 million around the world. In Bosnia, when the water supply to Sarajevo was cut off at the height of the siege, it was Soros who wrote a check to jury-rig a pipeline through an abandoned highway tunnel.
$5 million up front can be more valuable than $50 million a year or two later.
Ambassador Richard Holbrooke brokered the peace in Bosnia.
At one point, after the Dayton peace agreements in Bosnia in 1995, for a considerable period of time, George had given more money to implement the peace agreements than the U.S. government had. He just could move that fast.
In Russia, he pledged $100 million to help scientists who might otherwise have sold their expertise to bidders like Iran or Iraq. In Eastern Europe, he's educated a new generation. And in Ukraine, he spent millions retraining the old Soviet military.
At the center of George Soros, there's an inherent contradiction.
Which is?
which is, on one hand, you're the capitalist who does not care about the social consequences of his act, and on the other hand, you are a philanthropist who cares only about social consequences. How do you resolve the two?
Recognizing that as a competitor, I've got to compete to win. As a human being, I am concerned about the society in which I live.
Which George Soros am I talking to now, the amoral George Soros or the moral George Soros?
It's one person who at one time engages in amoral activities and at the rest of the time tries to be moral.
To understand the complexities and contradictions in his personality, you have to go back to the very beginning, to Budapest, where George Soros was born 68 years ago, to parents who were wealthy, well-educated, and Jewish.
When the Nazis occupied Budapest in 1944, George Soros' father was a successful lawyer. He lived on an island in the Danube and liked to commute to work in a rowboat. But knowing there were problems ahead for the Jews, he decided to split his family up. He bought them forged papers, and he bribed a government official to take 14-year-old George Soros in and swear that he was his Christian godson. But survival carried a heavy price tag. While hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews were being shipped off to the death camps, George Soros accompanied his phony godfather on his appointed rounds, confiscating property from the Jews.
These are pictures from 1944 of what happened to George Soros' friends and neighbors.
You're a Hungarian Jew who escaped the Holocaust by posing as a Christian.
Right.
And you watched lots of people get shipped off to the death camps.
Right. I was 14 years old. And I would say that that's when my character was made.
In what way?
That one should think ahead, one should understand and anticipate events, and one is threatened. It was a tremendous threat of evil. I mean, it was a very personal experience of evil.
My understanding is that you went out with this protector of yours who swore that you were his adopted godson.
Yes, Christian. Yes.
Went out, in fact, and helped in the confiscation of property from the Jews.
That's right. Yes.
So there's George Soros there saying, confessing actually to aiding the Nazis. Now, do you think people that criticise him are anti-Semitic?
I think some of them definitely are. But that doesn't mean he's above criticism, does it? I mean, some of the people, I mean, Soros is a whipping boy for many right-wing nationalists across Europe and elsewhere in the US, because of all the billionaires that we've got, he chooses to give some of his money to liberal causes. Sheldon Adelson, who is also Jewish, is a right-wing racist maniac, but we hardly hear anything about him and nobody criticizes him. Soros comes in for a lot of grief because basically of all the billionaires out there, he's got more liberal politics than most of them, which is why he gets it in the neck from both ends.
He used his money, for example, to train the Ukrainian army after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, he did. I mean, the fact is Soros is a...
He was seen as a saviour in Ukraine.
Well, listen, when I was working in Eastern Europe, Tony, I applied to his Open Society Fund for various projects that I wanted to fund, and he had the money, and I applied for him to get the money off him.
Were you successful in what sort of things?
Occasionally we did get little bits of money from him, but, I mean, the point is lots of people did. I wasn't particularly successful with that, but lots of people were. I mean, the thing about Soros is he's not above criticism, but some of the criticism he comes in for is, frankly, and it is for anti-Semitic, the right-wing don't like him because of his liberal politics, and they don't particularly like him in the right-wing government in Israel. But on the other hand, like a lot of wealthy people, he wants a pat on the back for just being, you know, for not being a fascist, and that's not good enough, really. I mean, you know, he basically in certain circumstances he's very, very anti-Russian, he's very, very anti-Chinese, he's basically in league with the Western powers.
Okay, let's have a little peep at Hong Kong briefly, because the activists have been jailed, these umbrella movement leaders, and some say it shows just how much freedom of speech is being restricted in the city. There is all these new laws coming in Hong Kong where any kind of criticism of President Xi, for example, can land you in jail. And these guys are obviously real big thought criminals, because they're saying, well, actually, wouldn't it be nice to have a bit of democracy? And that's basically what they've been jailed for.
The tensions between the West and China are palpable. The Chinese shouldn't be doing things like that, obviously. But don't forget, they are quite right to presume that the Western powers are trying to subvert their system and overthrow it, and therefore they're paranoid about it. They would be.
Okay, Bilderberg conference this year. Now, it's been... Usually by this time of the year, we know where Bilderberg is going to be. This is it's always very awkward. It was interesting to see one of the main UK Bilderberg people, Kenneth Clark, on Question Time last night, but he never, ever mentions his involvement with the Bilderberg conferences and also their lack of proper charitable status and lack of declaration of interest, all that sort of thing that those in Parliament, MPs, have just simply hidden over the years. So it does look as if this may be taking place in Ottawa, because one of the former venues, Martin, it should be in Europe this year, but it may be that Bilderberg are thinking twice about having something in Europe, and as things are hotting up with the EU elections and Brexit, and the Italians are all starting to be very critical of the EU project, which Bilderberg is so closely associated with.
Well, I mean, it's hard to know what the motive, you know, what Bilderberg, as you know, is a secret organisation that pretended it didn't exist for years, and people who attended it said they didn't attend a meeting, and people who said that Bilderberg existed were paranoid conspiracy theorists. They've now got their own website. As you know, Tony, you bought the domain name Bilderberg years ago. They didn't have it. They didn't buy their own domain name.
It's very interesting to see it sliding down the Google rankings.
Because
over the years, it was number one for many years, and now Google have found various algorithms to kick it off.
Well, they've got their own website
now. It does look as if
now.
It will be in Wednesday the 15th to Sunday the 19th of May at the Brook Street Hotel in Ottawa this year, and you can follow that on my show page too if you like. Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8 now. Thanks to all our guests this week. This show's podcast, story links and comment page is at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join us for the politics show, 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters, especially the ones in Basel, get you down. News Centre.